This is Adam Fenderson. I'm talking to Richard Douthwaite in Dublin. It's the 26th of June, I hope. And Richard, of course, is the author of Growth Illusion, Short Circuit and the Ecology of Money, and he's a founding member of FASTA, the Foundation for the Economics of Sustainability. Richard, what I wanted to ask about today, and I'm slightly apologetic for bringing up such a technical manner because you did such a wonderful job of having a quite holistic quite a broad way of summarising the proceedings of the conference, but we're going to talk about a rather technical thing today, which draws perhaps on your past experience as an economist, or perhaps perhaps it doesn't. But the idea that when we go to a bank and we get a loan out, we pay interest on that loan. Now, it seems quite natural and ordinary enough, even if you don't like it. You've written about on several occasions how that concept, that mechanism, is actually one of the underlying drivers for growth in the economy.
It's not so much the payment of interest which is a driver for growth. That's a very small factor. It's the real reason why an economy has to grow is that the money that we borrow goes into circulation. In fact, borrowed money constitutes about 97% of all the money that's used in a modern economy. The 3% is simply the notes and coins that we have in our pocket. So if you've paid off all your loans, you don't have a mortgage, you have money in the bank, you only have it there because somebody somewhere has borrowed it. So when you approach your bank for a loan, they authorise you to, in fact, create money. So supposing you wanted to buy a car, you would agree a loan with the bank, write a cheque to the car dealer. Your account goes down by $10,000, let's say. The bank, the car dealer's account goes up by $10,000. So that's put money into circulation because the car dealer can now go and spend that. So that creates activity in the economy. But over the next 2 years, you're going to have to repay that car loan. So as you repay it, you're taking money out of the circular flow in the economy again. And so to keep the same amount of money in the circular flow, somebody else has to be borrowing, or you have to be taking out another loan. And unless the economy is buoyant, people are going to be a bit frightened. You know, if you think, oh, I better not take out a car loan now because I don't know what's going to happen to my job, the company's making layoffs. Or if you think it's not a good time to buy a house, at the moment, house prices are tending to fall. If I wait a year, I might get it cheaper. Then these are self-fulfilling prophecies. People stop putting as much money into the circular flow by taking out new loans as old ones are being repaid. And if there's less money in the circular flow, then less business can go on. I mean, none of us have as much money coming into us, as much money in our bank accounts, and we can't do as much business as we could. I used to run a business, and it was in a very difficult time about 20 years ago, and I used to have to spend a lot of my time on the telephone chasing people who owed me money, and people spent the time on the phone ringing me up and saying, why hadn't I paid? And I wanted to do more business with my suppliers, but I couldn't until I'd paid the last month's bill off. And people who were buying from me were in exactly the same position. The whole economy had sludged up because there wasn't an adequate supply of money in circulation. Well, that's borrowed money. And so unless the economy grows, unless people find that they need to expand their businesses and they need to borrow to do that, unless there's this expansion, then the amount of money people borrow is going to tend to fall. In particular, supposing no growth happens this year, it means that all the money that was invested last year in trying to generate growth hasn't produced any results. People are paying interest on it. They're going to have to start making repayments on it. But there's no need for anybody to borrow to increase their facilities for the following year. So repayments are made, but no new loans are taken out for investment projects. And this means that the roughly 20% of the population who are involved in the construction sector, in equipping new factories, this sort of thing, they're going to find themselves out of work. They're going to fall back onto social welfare. They're going to spend less. Because they're spending less, other people lose their jobs, and the whole economy enters a downward spiral. So this is the reason that governments have to work very closely with the business sector to keep the economy growing, because they've got to keep us borrowing more and more each year. The only little bit that interest pays in that is that's an additional extraction. So you don't just pay your loan back, that's just the amount of money you borrowed, you have to pay a little bit more too in interest. Now, some of that does come back into the circular flow because the bank has costs. The bank may have borrowed money from people, so it may be paying a lower rate of interest. It has its buildings to maintain, its staff to pay. So the only net extraction you're getting from the economy is the profits that the banks make. And banks generally make pretty large profits. So that's the additional amount of borrowing that has to take place year after year, the total of the bank's profits. So
that would be profits which aren't returned to shareholders.
Exactly, right. Yes. These are the bank's retained earnings. Mm. And banks say, well, we need this level of retained earnings so that we can lend out more next year, because there's a relationship between the amount that a bank can lend and the amount of capital that it has. So the retained earnings increase the bank's capital.
So this is something that they do as a matter. That's the standard thing that they do, is to retain a certain amount of their earnings as they retain it in their own bank account.
Yeah.
As capital for future loans.
That's right. This is, so a bank can typically lend 12 times the amount of its own capital that it has. So an argument that's frequently made by the Irish banks, which are amongst the most profitable in the world for their huge profits, is the Irish economy is growing, we need to lend more and more out each year, we need to have this level of retained earnings if we're to facilitate this expansion process. So once you've got the expansion process going, once you've got 20% of the working population dependent on it, then you're riding the tiger. Because if you stop, then the economy is going to rapidly unwind. And this is why every government, whatever its political complexion, has to pay first attention to maintaining short-term economic sustainability, which in its terms means economic growth, as opposed to looking after the environment or looking after social sustainability, which are longer term things that might not impinge on it in the same way come the next election.
So just to make sure that I understand this correctly, if banks weren't charging interest, we'd still have the kind of instability with the potential for these the feedback of, you know, of a slowing economy could happen at any time anyway. So that's the impetus why we need to have pressure for growth, just because the alternative
is a collapse. Yes, our economy, our economic system is permanently hovering between going into sort of overdrive in inflation, because in good conditions, you know, when an economy is booming, other people want to borrow. So it's likely to fly off either extreme expansion or go into a recession or depression. It's very difficult to keep a middle course. And what we can't say, and what we ought to be able to say in a country like Australia or Ireland is, you know, these are rich countries in comparison with the rest of the world. We don't need to grow anymore. Mm. And roughly 50% of all energy use is involved in the growth process, because the materials used in putting up buildings are very energy intensive. There's an awful lot of transportation going on. In meeting the challenge of oil peak, it would be very useful if we could say, we don't need to grow anymore. We're able to stop growth, because this would cut our fossil energy use, and it would free up energy for those parts of the world which don't have a big enough capital stock, which badly need better water supplies, sewage supplies, housing, the poorer parts of the world. But because we've got this ridiculous system that requires continual growth, whether we need it, whether we want it or not, just to keep the system going, just to prevent an economic collapse, then we've got to consume more and more energy. And this is one of the things that makes it so difficult to do anything about climate change. Governments are only going to be able to respond to climate change within the present economic system if they can continue economic growth. And really, that makes me very gloomy about the prospects of anything worked out internationally to succeed the Kyoto Protocol. We've got to change the type of economic system we have to be able to respond both to oil peak and to the climate crisis.
Now, the type of growth that you're talking about is growth in the money supply, which is tied back into the real economy, in the sense that in the past, when we've had a rising energy base, we've had things to invest that money into, and that they've managed to maintain relatively in parallel. So the growth in the money supply and the growth of natural things which we've been able to invest in and monetarise has meant that we've managed to maintain a certain amount of stability. Now, are those real assets and the amount of money in circulation, is that already beginning to diverge?
One of the interesting things that's happened over the past three or four years in many economies around the world has been asset price inflation. Mm. So there hasn't been, to an extent, an expansion in the real economy, by which you might mean the goods and services that make life possible. There's been a sort of superstructure that has developed, and people are earning their income from this superstructure, but it's essentially they're making incomes in the financial services area, and they're dealing in things like the transfer of shares city centre properties. An enormous amount of speculation has been going on. So a lot of money has been going into the economies. There's been a tremendous amount of borrowing going on, which is, as I just said, the way that money is created. In Ireland, the amount that people owe has been growing, has been doubling roughly every 3 years. This has not been reflected by, obviously, the amount that we're spending on food and that sort of thing. It's a lot of it has been soaked up by people paying more and more for their houses. There's been a tremendous house price inflation. And because more money has been available to lend, people have had to borrow more to be able to compete in the market. And this has taken away choices. Until very recently, somebody on the average industrial wage would have been able to afford to buy a house on a mortgage out of his or her salary, and his or her partner would have been able to stay at home and raise the kids. That is no longer an option. Two and possibly more salaries. I mean, you know, people are having to increasingly get help from their parents to get into the market. And so a woman has to go back to work very soon after having a child. And this isn't good either for, you know, the family, and particularly for the child, which is farmed out with childminders. The system has run away with itself.
Now, I just really want to hammer this point home, so, because a lot of people wouldn't have come up against this argument before, but so it's quite an alien thing that all money is tied to debt, and that if, you know, in the peak oil community, a lot of people are recommending that we get out of debt before any financial crisis happens. Of course, if we recommended that to everybody, there would be no money left in circulation except for the notes and coins. That's correct, is it?
That's right. I mean, our system couldn't function without people being in debt, unless we find another way of putting money into circulation.
Yeah.
And this would be very much better. And so I've been doing some work in this area, and ideally, what should happen is that government should spend money into circulation, rather than private individuals lending it into circulation. So, what would happen is that the banks would cease to have the power to authorize you or anybody else to create money. This has a very distorting effect anyway, because it's only people with collateral or good prospects that they will lend to. So it skews who gets the money. Mm-hmm. And if people if a bank is prepared to make you a loan, then that gives you much better prospects than somebody who doesn't. So. And it also skews the way an economy develops, because if you go to them with a business proposition, it's only something that they consider to be bankable. And this has meant that organisations, let's say voluntary organisations, who have an extremely good record of borrowing, when they're able to do so, far better than a small business person, can't in fact get loans. So it's...
That's to do with the perception of the bank manager.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, but there are organizations. There's an organization. I think it's New Zealand rather than Australia, called Prometheus, which is based on Rudolf Steiner's thinking. And they have a close relationship with the Triodos Bank, which works in Britain, Ireland, and the Netherlands. And this lends to good causes. Mm. And they very rarely get a bad debt. Mm. I mean, a conventional bank manager would cry, you know, at seeing how well they're doing. But they're lending to people, you know, to people and groups that want to carry out community projects. Mm. And they get their money back, but they're only able to work because the conventional banks have completely ignored this sector and gone for purely, essentially, business related ones or personal ones where, you know, there is good security. So the present system distorts the way the economy develops. So instead of having banks lend money into circulation like that, banks would be limited to doing what they pretend to do, and that is acting as an intermediary between savers and lenders. So they wouldn't be able to authorise the creation of money in the way I described. Instead, a government would spend money into circulation, building, let us hope, things that would increase the sustainability of the country in the long term. It could be paid over to people who are unemployed, social welfare, this sort of thing. It doesn't matter how that money gets into circulation. Employ more teachers, whatever it is. That money would go into the circular flow in the economy, but the government couldn't carry on spending. It has to moderate the control the amount of money in the circular flow by taking out as much in tax as it's putting in. This would halve the amount of debt in the economy. So there would still be debt in the economy, interest would still be paid, but the debt that is taken to put the money supply into place would disappear.
Yeah.
And what we've done, you see, with the present money system is essentially we've privatized the creation of a commons. I mean, the money supply is public. We should have created it, and by having government create it, essentially, that's being done on our behalf. Instead, what we're doing is we've given these commercial banks a very important income stream by giving them the right to authorize the creation of money. So it's bad on all counts. It makes the economy basically unstable. It skews the way it develops, and it imposes on us all a higher interest burden than need be the case. If we relieved this interest burden, then the banking sector would fall in size. It wouldn't be getting this subsidy. We'd have to pay more for running our bank accounts, but we would have the choice, you know, of just what banking services we need. But it would, because there wasn't this burden of debt, it could make a national economy very much more competitive. You know, it would have an advantage over other national economies that are still operating the financial system that way. So this is a very important way that it could be used to sell the idea to politicians.
So at the moment, the government, of course, is getting in or raising capital through selling bonds, and that's all coming. So they're using private banks themselves as well, aren't they, on top of that?
Oh, they're using private banks. So the private bank, which is creating the money just by a book entry,
yeah,
is then charging the government for the privilege of using the money, you know.
Yeah.
That way, the government is in fact subsidising the banking system.
Is there any chance that we can begin to undo the kind of damage which is done by growth to the environment and to communities without reforming the monetary system?
I think the short answer is no. That if you have to keep the economy growing, to generate that growth, you have to use more and more energy, more and more resources year after year. You know, you've got a juggernaut, you've got to keep the juggernaut running. I don't see how we can. And yet, this is the attractiveness of the monetary reform idea. Just change the rules. Really a very moderate change that needs to be made. You just change the conditions under which commercial banks operate, and you've done it. You don't need to have an economy that grows, because under the new arrangement, supposing the economy didn't grow, supposing unemployment began to appear, then government would just spend and could use the unemployed to do whatever it wished to do. And those resources are going to be vitally important to make the transition to sustainability. Because if we think of sustainability for the moment purely in energy terms, building a high level type of society and economy that is purely based on renewable energy, we're going to need a lot of people to do that. Mm. And so as the economy released resources by turning down the conventional economy, then government, through agencies or whatever, can put in enough money cautiously. It mustn't cause an inflation, but it could pick up the slack and move the economy in the desired direction.
And I guess with the global peak in oil production, we can expect that collapse in the economic system is something of a given, which maybe these like things which would sound a bit hypothetical to people and a little bit ambitious, that could be, well, whenever there's crises, there's potential for introducing these ideas.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that the chances that we will manage to get through oil peak without a collapse are fairly slim. I think what will tend to happen is that the collapse will be because central banks bring it about. See, what could happen, the benign scenario is that energy prices move up. It becomes, at last, quite profitable to develop renewable energy supplies. People twig on to the fact that oil peak is taking place. You get business people saying, there's an opportunity here. So while there is money being taken out of the consumer sector because we're all spending more money to fill our car or heat our houses or whatever it is, we can't spend so much on consumer durables and so on. The slack will be picked up by business people borrowing and putting in wind turbines or whatever. So you could get a benign scenario. So there's no need to be a crash. In fact, you could get so many people sort of investing in energy related projects because they see the possibility of this, and because fossil energy is needed to develop renewable energy projects, that there's an increased demand for fossil energy because of that. You know, the world decides to switch. We're into the transition now, boys. Let's go for it, you know. Yeah. That oil prices rise because of the demand to make the switch. You know, you could get this positive feedback. But the danger is that central banks will say, we've been given the job by governments to limit inflation to 3%. And so oil prices rise. This has a knock-on effect to other prices. And you get more than a 3% inflation. They jack up in interest rates. That increases the costs to business because all businesses have borrowed. Mm-hmm. So businesses try and pass on those costs as well as the higher energy prices. That creates more inflation. So interest rates get jacked up even more and they go very high, and they so destroy the economy. They drive businesses into bankruptcy. Mm. All projects stop. Energy prices fall because there's no investment taking place, no infrastructural investment, no switch to renewables, because we just can't borrow the money at these interest rates. We can't make the projects work any longer. So world oil prices fall back to say $15 a barrel. So flap over. And the market is no longer signaling that we need to go to renewables, and it's no longer profitable to do so. But we've collapsed the world economy, and we've got hundreds of millions of people unemployed. Mm. And so, you know, that scenario could persist for 10 years, 20 years, because once growth has stopped, once investment has stopped, there's all sorts of excess capacity. It's very difficult to get the world economy going again. But let's supposing it did. The same cycle could be repeated.
Well, I mean, what would you like to do, Julian? We could,
what was your next question going to be?
We're actually kind of finishing up, I think. I was going to ask, as an aside...
Did I finish that one? I think I probably did.
It actually did finish quite remarkably well. I was just going to ask you so you call yourself a reformed economist?
Recovering
is a good term. Economics is one of the things. Had his name on the tip of my tongue. Who called a disabling discipline? Ivan Illich. Ivan Illich had called medicine a disabling discipline. Well, economics is too. It forces you to think about the world in a particular way. And it's very difficult, once you've gone through an economics training, to think about it in any other way. So you need to be out of economics a bit before you can think more freely. So the advantage of an economics training is that you're not frightened to go into the economics area, as a lot of sort of non-economists are. They say, oh, that's economics. No, I don't know about that. So once you have it and then you get the distance from it, then you can challenge the disciplines. The only other people who really effectively challenge economists are people who don't do economics as their first degree. They do something else. They might be mathematicians, physicists. It doesn't much matter what. But their identity isn't involved in being an economist. So they take up economics. They see where it's failing. And it's from these people that change within the economics profession is taking place. No, it's the typical picture that change always takes place on the fringes, which are exposed to new influences. But the profession as a whole is very incestuous, very inward looking. They don't like to debate. They circle the wagons, and it's essentially completely unreal and completely depersonalized. I mean, they have to separate people out from everything they're considering, which is why sociologists and economists are at loggerheads. They can barely speak to each other.